So, children, I have a question for you to start today. Have you ever fallen asleep in the middle of something when you should have been awake? Has that ever happened? Maybe you started watching a movie with your family and you were enjoying the movie and suddenly you don't know what's going on and you wake up later and you don't even know how the movie ended. Or maybe you were in a worship service and you fell asleep before it was over. Now, I've seen that, and not just with children. In our text today, the disciples Peter, James, and John fall asleep when they really should have stayed awake. They were with Jesus, and he told them to stay awake while he went away a little distance to pray. But when he came back to check on them, do you think they were awake? No, they had fallen asleep. And it didn't happen just one time. Jesus came back a second time and found them asleep. Then he came back a third time and he found them to sleep. The fact is that Jesus was at one of the most difficult points in his life, praying to his Father in anticipation of his coming death. And at such a time, even his closest disciples did not support him by staying awake and praying for him. Thankfully, our salvation does not rest on the performance of the disciples or any other human being, including ourselves. Our salvation rests on Jesus, who in the midst of suffering and natural human fear, remained committed to obeying God, whatever the cost, that we might be saved. And that is what we will consider this morning as we work our way through this passage, as we see Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. We begin with verse 32. Then they came to a place which was named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Now, the name Gethsemane means oil press, and since it was a place where we know olives grew, it was likely a place where at least at some time there had been a press to make olive oil. Luke tells us the garden was located on the Mount of Olives, and it's likely close to the location of the previous episode on that mount. John identifies it as a garden where Jesus had often met with his disciples. And this explains how Judas knew where to find Jesus to complete his act of betrayal. Gethsemane may have been a grove of olive trees enclosed in some way, perhaps by a wall. To this place, where they had come before, Jesus now repairs with his disciples. Judas likely had already departed from them, or perhaps did so when they were on their way. And Jesus reveals his purpose in his instructions. He tells them, "Sit here while I pray." A rather simple instruction, "Sit here while I pray." Verse 33, "And he took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be troubled and deeply distressed." So leaving the other disciples at one place, Jesus moves further into the garden with Peter, James, and John. Now these three, you may recall, form the inner core of the 12. They alone of the 12 had been with Jesus when he raised Jairus' daughter from the dead and at his transfiguration. And with the addition of only Andrew, they had received Jesus' private prophecy about the coming destruction of the temple. Once more, Peter, James, and John are invited to be with Jesus at a momentous time. And we read that Jesus began to be troubled and deeply distressed. And these words refer to strong distress, great shock, even alarm. Jesus is visibly shaken, and he does not hide his troubled state from his closest disciples. Indeed, he speaks to them about it. Verse 34, "Then he said to them, 'My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch.'" Now this statement, "my soul is exceedingly sorrowful," echoes the vocabulary of the Greek translation of the refrain from Psalms 42 and 43, which we read this morning. Those two psalms united in their common theme of the psalmist feeling distant from God amidst the taunts of his enemies. That's what unites them. And three times the refrain occurs, "Why are you cast down on my soul, and why are you disquieted within me?" And again, it's the Greek translation of that, which is echoed here in Jesus' words. In Gethsemane, Jesus seems to be inhabiting this psalm and living it out in all its despair and desperation. This is the psalm in which the cry goes up. Vindicate me, O God, and plead my cause against an ungodly nation. O deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man. How appropriate it is for Jesus to express his condition in words from this psalm as he anticipates betrayal by one of his own disciples. The deceitful, the unjust man. He then says to Peter, James, and John, stay here and watch. So Jesus brings them so far with him, farther than the other disciples, but now he will go on alone. And we note two things at this point. First of all, this is not the first time Jesus has left the disciples for a time of solitary prayer. He did so after his first hectic day of ministry, in which he cast a demon out of a man in the synagogue at Capernaum, healed Peter's mother-in-law, and performed many more healings and exorcisms from the crowds that came to his door. But the next morning, Jesus arose early and went out into a desert place to pray. Then again, after the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus sent his disciples across the sea on a boat while he went up on a mountain to pray. And one thing we see here in Gethsemane is Jesus continuing his pattern of seeking out times of solitary prayer where he can commune with his Father and discern his will. Secondly, the other thing we note is that this whole narrative stresses Jesus' increasing isolation. He begins with 12 disciples, departs from all but three of them, and now he departs even from those three. Jesus is ultimately alone in the experience of his passion. That's the case here in the garden, and it will be highlighted again in the sequel when all his disciples leave him. Now he tells them to watch. And these three disciples had recently heard that very command from the lips of their Lord. As we noted, they formed the private audience when Jesus spoke about the coming destruction of the temple. Three times at the end of that discourse, Jesus uses this verb in telling them to be prepared for what is to come. Specifically, he calls them to watch, to stay awake, lest they be like servants found sleeping when their master returns. And this same verb, again, is used three times here in verses 34, 37, and 38, as Jesus calls them to watch and stay awake while their master prays. An impending sense of doom from that earlier episode on the Mount of Olives is thus drawn forward into this episode in a garden on that same mount. Verses 35 to 36. He went a little farther and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. So here we see Jesus' increasing isolation as he goes further. He falls on the ground and he prays. Now, falling on the ground seems to express something other than a normal posture of prayer. It is suggestive of Jesus' anguish. We hear of Jesus' prayer from two angles. First, Mark gives us a summary. He writes that Jesus prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And then we hear some of the specific words Jesus spoke. Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. So let's reflect upon Jesus' prayer. The words hour and cup are used synonymously in reference to the complex of events surrounding Jesus' coming death. And the use of cup particularly helps us see something of the meaning of Jesus' death, a meaning that explains why he is so troubled as he prays to his Father here in the garden. You see, in the Old Testament, cup imagery was often used in reference to the pouring out of God's wrath. So, for instance, we have this passage about divine judgment upon Jerusalem in Isaiah 51. Wake yourself, stand up, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of Yahweh the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering. In the book of Revelation, we read of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. You see, it's not just physical death that Jesus is anticipating, though that is part of it. That alone is not what makes him quiver with anguish. It is the fact that he knows that his death will involve God pouring out his wrath upon him. And as we saw last week, Jesus knows that he is designated to be the sin offering for his people. That means he knows that his Father, with whom he has had eternal intimacy and fellowship, will turn against the sin he bears in the fullness of his divine holy fury. That is the cup that Jesus is anticipating drinking. That is what will happen in the hour that is fast approaching. Is it any wonder that Jesus cries out in prayer, "Abba, Father"? Now, Abba is an Aramaic term of paternal intimacy. While it's not exactly the equivalent of our daddy, as some have claimed, there is a sense of intimacy in this term for which there is no precedent in Jewish prayer before Jesus takes it upon his lips. He cries out as a son to his Father and declares in faith, "All things are possible for you." And in doing so, he affirms God's omnipotence. He affirms God's utter sovereignty. All things are possible. But that is not the only possibility involved here. When Jesus asks whether it is possible for the hour to pass from him, and when he pleads for the cup to be removed, he is asking whether it is possible for these things to happen within God's plan of salvation. And Jesus' true humanity is racked in pain as he contemplates dying and experience the wrath of God poured out upon him. Luke tells us that his sweat became like great drops of blood falling to the ground. Every fiber of Jesus' being cries out against that experience. If there's any way for God to save a people for himself without Jesus going through this agony and divine rejection on the cross, then he pleads with God to choose that other way. But even in this anguished plea, Jesus submits himself to the plan of his Father, saying, "Not what I will, but what you will." With great pathos, Jesus expresses his fear to his Father, but at the same time, he expresses his utter commitment to carry out his Father's will. If there is no other way, then Jesus will walk the way of the cross. Verse 37. Then he came and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour?" Remember, Jesus had instructed Peter, James, and John, "Stay here and watch." When Jesus returns, he finds them sleeping. He singles out Peter and asks, "Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour?" And note how Jesus addresses Peter. He calls him Simon. When Jesus constituted the 12 as the core of the new Israel, Jesus had given Simon the new name Peter, which means rock. But Peter does not seem to be living up to that name at the moment. There may well be significance in Jesus addressing him with his pre-apostolic name. Remember, this is the apostle who had just emphatically declared, "If I must die with you, I will not deny you." That was bold, Peter. But now we see sleeping Simon. As Jesus goes through a deep trial, agonizing over his coming hour, he asks sleeping Simon, "Could you not watch 1 hour?" Suggesting that his prayer had already been for quite a long time. Now those words are spoken in the second person singular. In other words, he directs that directly to Peter, but he now shifts to the second person plural in addressing the other disciples there. Verse 38, "Watch and pray lest you all enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." So Jesus repeats his command to them to watch, but also adds that they should pray that they may not enter in temptation. Now, the first mention of temptation in Mark's gospel was Satan's temptation of Jesus in the wilderness back in chapter 1. And Jesus may be warning them that refusing to watch and to support him in this time plays into the hands of Satan. It is certainly Satan who would seek to pull them away from their Lord. The obedience of discipleship doesn't just happen. It takes concerted effort and struggle. The Spirit indeed is willing, Jesus says, but the flesh is weak. And as events unfold, these three disciples do not show themselves to be resisting the flesh. Verses 39 and 40. Again, he went away and prayed and spoke the same words. And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to answer them. He goes and he prays the same words again. There's only one thing on his mind, only one thing on his heart, and he is pouring it out to his Father. Again, Jesus returns to Peter, James, and John and finds them sleeping. He apparently wakes them again, and we're told they did not know what to answer him. And that's another echo of the experience of these three on the Mount of Transfiguration, when after Peter babbles on about building tents for Jesus, Moses, and Elijah, Mark explains he did not know what to say, for they were greatly afraid. Once again, they do not know what to say. And though it seems to have been a rare occurrence, Peter is left speechless. And here the three clearly have no defense to justify themselves for their second failure to obey Jesus' express and rather simple command. But they do get one more chance, verses 41 to 42. Then he came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." So we're to understand that Jesus goes away, he prays a third time, and when he returns, he finds them once more asleep. And the contrast between Jesus and the disciples is highlighted here. While Jesus is enduring one of the deepest trials of his life, his closest disciples are taking their rest. While they have not yet physically abandoned him and scattered, they do seem to have spiritually abandoned him. And we see here another aspect of Jesus' utter isolation in the garden. While Jesus pours out his heart to his Father, they are napping. They won't get another chance to show solidarity with Jesus in Gethsemane. And now we learn the answer to Jesus' prayers. He says, "It is enough. The hour has come." Now remember what Jesus had asked. Jesus had asked that if it were possible for the hour to pass from him, and if the cup could be taken away, that is what he desired. And what was his Father's answer to the prayer? No. His Father's answer was no. It is not possible, because Jesus' substitutionary death is absolutely essential for the salvation of his people. Now, don't skip over this too quickly. It is really an amazing thing. Jesus made a request in prayer from the depths of his being to his heavenly Father, who responded with the answer, no. And Jesus tells them, "The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners." This is another statement about the Son of Man that turned typical Jewish expectations on their heads. According to Daniel 7, the Son of Man is given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. That's the image they have of the Son of Man. Yet now we're told that this one, who's supposed to have dominion over all, is going to be betrayed into the hands of sinners. You see, Jesus knew what they did not know. Jesus knew that he was both Son of Man and suffering servant. And his Father's will called him to experience the agony of the suffering servant before he would enter into the glory of the Son of Man. The cross would come before the crown. Having received the answer to his prayers, though it was not what in his humanity Jesus wanted, He submits to his father's will. He steps forth to embrace it. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. Back at Mark 9:31, Jesus had prophesied, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of men. And Jesus will not resist that betrayal now that it has arrived. And we'll find out more about that when we pick up the text next time. But let's reflect a bit more about the experiences of Peter, James, and John. They formed that inner core of the 12. Again, Jesus invited them to witness things not seen by the rest of the disciples. They were in the room of Jairus' 12-year-old daughter who was dead. And they watched Jesus take her by the hand, lift her up, and raise her to life. They were on the Mount of Transfiguration when Moses and Elijah appeared in glory and talked with Jesus. In those episodes, they saw something of Jesus' power and glory. They were getting a glimpse of the divine side of this God-man. Now, these same three are also with Jesus in Gethsemane. They see Jesus troubled and deeply distressed. They heard him say to them, words borrowed from the psalmist, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. And it's possible that they were within earshot and heard some of Jesus' anguished cries of prayer to his Father before they fell asleep. At Gethsemane, they see Jesus in his true humanity, recoiling from a death that will see God's wrath poured out upon him. This is the other side of Jesus, the God-man. Jesus was and is fully and truly human. Now, if you spend much time talking about the faith with unbelievers, you will find yourself defending the deity of Jesus, that Jesus is God. You'll dig through Scripture to show that the united testimony of the Bible is that Jesus is divine. He is God the Son, one of three persons in the triune Godhead. And that is a good and necessary thing to do as we seek to lead others toward faith in Jesus. They need to know who he is. They need to know his divinity. But it is equally important that you remember Jesus was and also is truly human. The doctrine of the true humanity of Jesus is vitally important for your daily walk. Consider the testimony of the author of the book of Hebrews. Inasmuch then as children have partaken of flesh and blood, the Son himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death. In order to defeat death in humanity, he had to become a human being. And then two chapters later in Hebrews we read, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Now you've heard that verse many times before, but today I'd like you to think of it perhaps in a new light. I'd like you to think of it in relation to Jesus in Gethsemane. Jesus can sympathize with your weaknesses. Are you ever overcome by fear or dread about circumstances in your life? Jesus experienced that in Gethsemane. Are you ever disappointed when friends let you down in a big way? Jesus experienced that in Gethsemane. Are you sometimes at the end of your rope that you just break down emotionally? Well, Jesus experienced that in Gethsemane. Are you afraid of death? Jesus experienced that in Gethsemane. Are you troubled because God's answer to your prayer requests seemed to be no? Jesus experienced that in Gethsemane. There are Christians in other communions who want to pray through other supposed mediators like the saints as if Jesus is too transcendent and can't understand them. But such thinking fails to take account of Jesus in Gethsemane. Such thinking is a denial of the true humanity of Jesus, which was necessary for our salvation. What does it say in Hebrews immediately after the affirmation that Jesus can sympathize with our weaknesses? Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. It is Jesus' true humanity, which included suffering that was greater than anything you or I will ever experience, that should give us confidence to approach the throne of grace in prayer Because whatever our prayer is, whatever it's coming from in our lives, Jesus understands it. And you can do so. You can approach that throne in prayer expecting to obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. God the Father's answer to the prayers of God the Son in Gethsemane was no. That is an astonishing fact. But Jesus still found mercy and grace to sustain him through betrayal, trial, suffering, and death. Though he had a unique calling to experience the most intense outpouring of God's wrath ever upon an individual, God sustained him even through that great trial and vindicated him through resurrection on the other side of it. Whatever your suffering may be, Jesus understands. Though no one on earth may understand, though no one in your family may understand, though no one in among your friends may understand, Jesus understands. And he loves you. And he demonstrated that by dying to pay the penalty for your sins, even though in his humanity he would shrink back from it. And he continues to demonstrate that love by interceding for you as your great high priest. If ever you feel completely overwhelmed so that you think you can't go on, remember Jesus in Gethsemane. If ever you are crippled by fear of the future, remember Jesus in Gethsemane. If ever you feel God isn't answering your prayers as you desire, remember Jesus in Gethsemane. Remember him and go to him in prayer, knowing that he hears you, he understands you, he loves you, and he will see to it that God sustains you as even as God sustained him through his darkest trial. And unlike Peter, James, and John in Gethsemane, Jesus will never be asleep when you need him. Let us pray.